A season of reflection, re-evaluation, new beginnings. A time to recognize God's grace in our lives, to find ways to let that realization sink in and take root. Drawing closer to God as we are changed by His love. In this season, we should give. Give of ourselves, our time, money, possessions. Giving helps us to see better the needs of those around us. It brings to light those things that may have too high a priority in our lives. It helps us to separate what we need from what we want, stripping away the things that keep us separated from one another and God. We should fast. It helps us to be reminded of the need for God to fill us, whether food or social media, your phone or computer. Fasting allows us to physically feel the ongoing spiritual needs of the soul. It helps us to see the truth that only God can truly satisfy. We should pray. It slows us down, focuses us on God. It enables us to be pulled away from our grip on the world and everything we think it can give us, and moves us closer to seeing God in the midst of it all. God is inviting us into this holy season, wanting us to be free from all the obstacles that keep us from His fullness. May we allow ourselves to be stripped down and cleansed, so that we may come to understand more powerfully the love of God and be made new in His righteousness and alive in His grace.
All right. I don't know if you guys want to make sure you heard that correctly. She has 22 siblings. Is that right, Susan? 22. I don't even think I have like that many aunts, uncles, and cousins and all that. So that blew my mind in and of itself. But thank you guys for being here, Susan and Ed. Hey, if you're new with us, my name is Mark Lohman, and I'm the associate pastor here at New Life. And as you can tell from that photo and the video that you just saw, we are entering this new four-week sermon series that is about Lent. And when I say the word Lent, it takes me back to my childhood where I confused the word Lent for lint, which is the stuff in your pockets and, dare I say, for some of you, perhaps in your belly button. But I won't go there. Anyway, so for me growing up, you know, my church tradition didn't really practice Lent. Every time I say Lent now, I'm going to think of Lent. I thought of it as, well, that's just something that Roman Catholics do. And I don't know, maybe you're here today and that's what you think as well. Actually, that's not true. There are quite a few Protestants who do celebrate and reflect on the Lent season. And it's actually, as I've noticed the last couple of years, becoming more and more popular, I think, for Protestants to engage in. And I think for good reason. So, what is Lent? Like, let's just kind of give a quick definition. Lent is just really from an old English word that means springtime. And so it's this idea that winter is passing away, and now spring is kind of rushing before us. And so in the Bible, Lent is structured completely around the 40 days that Jesus spent in the desert, in the wilderness. If you know the story, he was fighting off the temptations of Satan as he was beginning to prepare for his own ministry. And so, starting about a week and a half ago, we had our Ash Wednesday experience, and that was the official, like the first out of the 40 days of Lent. And so, yeah, we are a little, about a week and a half behind. So Lent, it's a time of fasting, preparation, reflection, self-examination, things that Jesus himself did in the 40 days that he was in the desert, in the wilderness. And so kind of the church throughout time has developed some traditions around this. They're not, well, they're in the Bible, but there isn't kind of a formula, if you will. And the three main practices of Lent are fasting, of prayer, and of giving. Maybe you've heard the formal word almsgiving, same thing. And so for the next three following Sundays, those are the three things that we're going to look at. And this Sunday, I'm going to kind of give us a launching pad into the season. But if you're anything like me, whenever I think of Lent, I actually think of kind of like a morbid season. And if I'm really honest, it's like, I have to give up things that I like. Not really my cup of tea, so to speak. And so, you know, there's quite a few studies out there. I looked at one a couple of days ago of like the top 10 things people give up for Lent. And, you know, it's usually things like, oh, I'm going to stop using Facebook and Twitter, or I'm not going to drink caffeine, or I'm going to stop drinking alcohol, or I'm not going to eat chocolate. And it just seems like kind of this like religious chore or this checklist that you do. And I think it's for that reason that I kind of just shy away from it. Furthermore, I'm not even really a chocolate person. So like I don't get the big deal about giving up 40 days of chocolate. For me, it's like, shouldn't you be doing that anyways? Probably most of the women in here are probably like, dude, you're nuts. My wife loves chocolate. So here are kind of my deeper questions about Lent, though. It seems to me a lot of the things I just named, and I want to be careful, I know my gut reaction is, aren't those things that like you should be giving up anyways? Like a lot of those things aren't good for you. Caffeine and chocolate, dare I say, all this other stuff. And then my bigger problem is this, if I step back, it's like, okay, so you're going to give this up for 40 days. But we all know what's going to happen afterwards. You're just going to dig right back into it. And so kind of, you know, where's like the real life change? Where's the heart transformation? And I think our culture has misunderstood Lent. I think we understand it as something that I need to give up. And what I want to say is actually, I think the invitation of Lent is to gain back your real self. The invitation of Lent is an invitation to practice the simple life, which is really the best life for you. It's the abundant life in Jesus. Chuck DeGroat says this, Lent is an invitation for growth, for springtime, and for reflection back to ourselves. And so to kick off this season for us, you just heard a bunch of desert wilderness talk. If you look at the picture on the screen, that, you know, kind of like a desert or something. I'm going to take us to a desert wilderness passage. And it's fascinating. If you look at the Bible, there are quite a few stories that have two things in common. The number 40, and that there's 40 days or 40 years, and that this happens in a desert or a wilderness. And so, like I said, Lent is structured around the 40 days that Jesus spent in the wilderness preparing for his ministry. But that's not the only thing. There were some very significant kind of history-changing events that involved a 40-day journey in the desert. So, for instance, you have Noah. God caused a great flood, and that was for 40 days and 40 nights. You have Moses. Think of Charlton Heston. All the young people are like, who's that? Yeah. Anyways, I'm just like thinking of like Brad like Pitt or someone playing Moses in like a modern day version. Anyways, so Moses, he's on Mount Sinai for what? 40 days, 40 nights receiving the 10 commandments. You have Israel, the people of God, who are wandering in the desert for 40 years, right? And then, as I said, you have Jesus in the desert for 40 days. But tucked away in the Old Testament, there is actually another story of an individual, guess what? In the desert for 40 days. And so we're going to look at this narrative as kind of a launching pad to get us into Lent and to begin to reflect on ourselves and ultimately back to God. And it's a passage, and I'm going to get into this at the end, that very seriously has deeply affected me in the last just month or two. So this is an exciting thing for me to get into. So we're going to open up to 1 Kings chapter 19. It is a book that probably most of us don't even really know where to find in the Bible, because we don't usually turn to 1 Kings. It's in the beginning of your Bibles. If you need a free Bible, we have these available. It's on page 247 in those. And I'm also proud to say, like, we have an app now at New Life. It is free. So if you have a smartphone, you can find it at New Life Artesia, and there is a Bible in that app that you can use to track along. But let me, this is a long passage, and there's a lot going on in it. So I just want to set the scene for us. Here's what you need to know. There are three characters in this story. The main character is Elijah, okay? Elijah is a prophet to the nation of Israel. Now, part of his job as a prophet is that he immediately gets a bad reputation. Because if there was a prophet, it usually meant that they're calling out all of the sin that the people are participating in. So he was not well liked by the people of Israel. Think of Elijah as kind of God's mouthpiece to Israel, of telling them to get out of all their wickedness and their evil. And part of the reason why Israel was living such a wicked and evil life is that they had an extremely wicked king, King Ahab, and he is our second character. I think it's 1 Kings 16, we learn, there's a verse that says, no one had done more evil before than King Ahab. The dude was messed up. But they say, you know, hey, behind every great man is a great woman. Well, behind the evil King Ahab was a bad, bad, bad lady. He married a foreign princess named Jezebel. Jezebel is the third character. Jezebel introduced the false god Baal to the people of Israel. And that was the god that now they were beginning to worship, thanks to Jezebel. And so right before 1 Kings 19, the chapter before us, there is like this epic showdown that little children learn about in like vacation Bible school and all that kind of stuff. And it's on this mountain, and it's between Elijah, who represents God, the one true God of Israel, and then Baal, this false god, and all of his false prophets. Go read it yourself. It's a really fun story. Long story short, of course, Elijah and God win. They beat them out. And so as a result, all the false prophets are killed. Like, pretty serious stuff. And so you have Elijah, this holy, righteous, go-getter guy who's like just went through this adrenaline-rushing victory. And we start 1 Kings 19:1. So, follow along with me. It's a bit long, but it's gonna be good. Chapter 19, verse 1. Now, Ahab, remember who Ahab is? Bad, evil king. He told Jezebel, his bad wife, everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the false prophets with the sword. And so Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them. Meaning, she's going to kill him tomorrow, just like he killed all of her false prophets. So naturally, Elijah was afraid and he ran for his life. And when he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there, while he himself went a day's journey into what? The wilderness. And he came to a broom bush. If you're wondering what that is, just like a desert shrub. And he sat down under it and he prayed that he might die. And how many of us have said these words before? I have had enough, Lord. Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. And then he lay down under the bush and he fell asleep. And all at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and read the first five books of the Bible, the Torah. No, that's not in there. Get up and eat. Cool. That'll preach. He looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. And he ate and he drank, and then what? Well, nap time, lay down again. And the angel Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, okay, Elijah, now get up and do some Bible reading. No, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. And so he got up and he ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled, here it is, 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. And then he went into a cave and he spent the night. And the word of the Lord came to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he replied, well, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites, they've rejected your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've put your prophets to death with the sword. And I am the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too. And the Lord said, I am so scatterbrained. When I first read this, I thought of like the movie Titanic, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet, and they like stand in front of the ship with their arms out. I don't know. I'm sorry, guys. The Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain. It's kind of an awkward thing to me. Stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. I mean, can you imagine being told that? Hey, why don't you go out, stand on the mountain, and like, God's going to pass by. Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake. We can relate to that. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. But after the fire came a gentle whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and he went out and he stood at the mouth of the cave. And then a voice said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he replied, well, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've torn down your altars and they've put your prophets to death with the sword. And I am the only one left. And now they're trying to kill me too. And then the Lord said to him, go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. And when you get there, anoint Hazael king over Aram. This morning, I just want to walk us through this lengthy, complicated passage and point out five very practical things. And because sometimes I can be ADD, this was going to bother me unless I came up with like a really cute, nice acronym. Are you guys ready for this? These all cleverly start with the letter R. So here are the five points of this passage. Retreat, rest, reflect, recognize God's voice, and refuel. Okay? So, first one, retreat. So, Elijah, he's depressed, he's exhausted, and boy, is he scared. So what does Elijah do? I mean, this is how we have to approach the Bible. I mean, act like you've never read it before. I mean, he could have gone like retail therapy shopping. He could have maybe kicked back a couple beers to numb his feelings. I'm just pointing stuff out here. No. But he heads south of where he was at. He goes to the desert. He leaves his servant, and intentionally by himself, he goes into the desert to practice solitude. An easy definition of retreat is for you to intentionally make time and space to practice solitude alone with God. And that's what Elijah does here. One author comments, Elijah was willing to walk into the emptiness of the desert to find the one thing that he was looking for. And Elijah's wilderness experience is a powerful metaphor for all of the emptiness of life that we often have to go through to encounter God. Here's a quote by a well-known Christian therapist, Dan Allender. He writes this. I think this is incredibly profound. Our spiritual journey must lead through the desert, or else our healing will be the product of our own will and wisdom. Listen to this. This is so relevant to our culture. It is in the silence of the desert that we hear our dependence on noise. It is in the poverty of the desert that we see clearly our attachments to the trinkets and baubles, I don't know what those are, that we cling to for security and pleasure. The desert shatters the soul's arrogance and leaves body and soul crying out in thirst and hunger. In the desert, we trust God or die. First question for us, are you making time to retreat? And honestly, like you don't need to go up to the mountains of Big Bear, Laguna Beach. I mean, those things help, don't get me wrong. All about retreats there. But all a retreat is simply you intentionally, and I'm using that word very intentionally, hey-o. Man, are we awake this morning? Gosh. Well, I guess we lost an hour of sleep last night, so that makes sense. Hey, but in a retreat, intentionally removing, setting apart time and space to practice solitude. I think you can do that in your backyard. I think you can do it at the local park. I think you can do it in your living room. But are you retreating? And so Elijah, he retreats. What does he do next? He rests. This is my favorite part of this passage. This is so awesome. Like, this is in the Bible, people. Let's reread this. Verse 5. So Elijah, he lays down under the bush, and he fell asleep. All at once, an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." And he looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank, and then what? Laid down again. Angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Get up and eat." And here's a phrase I want us to zero on. For the journey is too much for you. And so he got up and he ate and drank, and he was strengthened by that food. God's answer to Elijah's exhaustion and frustration was like the angel embodiment of like Martha Stewart or something. Emeril Lagasse, for those of you food people, okay? Who here knows Emeril Lagasse? Okay. My wife told me no one would know who that is. Bam, 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 there you go. So, eat and rest, for the journey is too much for you. Isn't this fascinating? Doesn't this speak into our culture? How many of us are just flat out exhausted, tired, stressed out, worn out, busy, and just done? You don't need to raise your hand. We're depleted. Psychologists, this is serious, I'm not making this up, have now identified something called hurry sickness. Hurry sickness, the behaviors of someone who has this, they are continually rushed, anxious, and they're overwhelmed by a sense of urgency. Are you wondering what the symptoms now are of hurry sickness? Here they are. These are fun. Moving from one checkout line to another because it looks shorter or faster. Anybody? Yes. How about this one? Counting the cars in front of you and either getting in the lane that has the least or is moving the fastest. Okay. Wow, Tina, that was like a quick hand right there. I saw that. Here's a good one. Multitasking to the point of forgetting one of the tasks. These are funny, but here's the crazy thing. Like, seriously, go Google psychology today, hurry sickness. Like these are, I'm not making this stuff up. Here's the last one. This is funny. Sleeping in your daytime clothes to save time in the morning. Don't tell me who does that. Let's hear these words again. The journey is too much for you. Chuck DeGroat also says this. Lent, it is for the exhausted, the frustrated, like all of the I can't do enoughers out there who need to know that you are enough in Jesus, who invites you to rest. To rest. I'm full of kind of research this morning. Did you know this? Just 150 years ago, like in the grand scheme of things, not that long ago, 150 years ago, the average amount of sleep that a human being got was 11 and a half hours a night. Any amens? Okay, that'll preach. I'm an 8-hour guy, so I'm just like, man, this is good. Guess what it is now? It's a little bit less than 7 hours a night. Here's the interesting thing. Why do people think this is? Most people would say it's because in 1879, the Edison light bulb was invented. People, humans naturally would sleep according to seasons, right? So when the sun would set, approximately 6, 7 p.m., people would go to sleep because they can't see, it's dark. And then they would wake up at sunrise, roughly 6 a.m. That's roughly 11 and a half hours of sleep. But now we have technology, we have lights, we have light bulbs, all these things, so we can stay up longer and we can get up earlier doing everything that we think we need to do. I was telling some people Friday night, you know, I would venture to guess that a lot of us, the last thing that you do at night is check your iPhone around midnight when you go to bed. And then the first thing you do is when you wake up in the morning and you check your iPhone. Oh, I have to send an email at 6 a.m., all sorts of stuff. We are consumed with living this way. A couple authors, theologians say this. These freeze me in my tracks. Hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day. Hurry is the form of violence to the soul. We need a slowed down spirituality. Are you resting? John Mark Comer says this, we have a problem and the problem is time, but the answer is not more time. The solution is to slow down and simplify our lives around the essentials of following Jesus. This leads to the third R, reflection. Let's continue on. So Elijah, he's strengthened by the food, travels 40 days to a cave. Verse 9. And then he went into a cave and he spent the night. And here's the reflection part. And the word of the Lord came to him. What are you doing here, Elijah? And he replied, well, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites, they rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, put your prophets to death, and I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. After we retreat and after we rest, you can begin to reflect And we do that because at that point, hopefully, we're able to remove all of the noise around us. And your heart begins to settle and it's scary. And God perhaps may be asking you, what are you doing? What are you doing? Now, God's not stupid. Doesn't mean this in the sense of like, Elijah, where are you? I mean, God knows where Elijah is. God knows where you are this morning. So it's not kind of like the flippant small talk. Hey man, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing good. How are you doing? Oh, good. Eh. No, no, not what's going on here. This is like the, dude, like, should you come over tonight? I feel like you need to talk through some things. Like, tell me like how you're doing. Some of us, all of us, need to be spending time reflecting. I think every week of your life, not just a Lent thing. You need to reflect with yourself and back to God. Here's what's interesting. Elijah did this and he was pretty honest with God. Like he didn't quote back, you know, some Christian bumper stickers, right? He just, hey, here's where I'm at, God. What, people are wanting to kill me now. Like, haven't I done what's holy and right? All your people are what's the problem and they're causing this whole thing I'm in. See, again, when you're practicing silence and solitude, you're able to retreat and rest and you begin to reflect and you're just removing all the noise around you. And I think when you begin to do that, it gets scary. Because we're not used to that. And it involves you having to open yourself up to the Creator. But you will never find healing unless you come out of hiding. And so I think Elijah finally gets to this point and he just starts unloading. And that's okay. That's a part of the reflection process. And it comes now to the fourth R, recognize. And by that I mean recognizing God's voice. Once you remove all the distractions around you, I think you can begin to recognize God's voice. Now, Elijah probably expected something very loud and obvious. I think we do too. Particularly because on this mountain that he's on, that was the same mountain that Moses was on. And Moses had a very obvious, loud and clear and explicit encounter with God. And so Elijah's probably thinking, oh yeah, I'm getting the same thing now. Not what happened. What happens? Very poetic. The Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord. For the Lord is about to pass by. Verse 11. And then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire, but a gentle whisper came. I wonder if we are unable to recognize God's voice because we have listened to so many other competing voices around us. What are the voices? Well, here's one, our new fifth appendage, an iPhone. How about TV? How about your workout schedule? How about all the extracurricular activities of children and grandchildren? I was just at the Artesia baseball ceremony yesterday. All good things, totally not complaining about those things. Here's my point though. We live in an extremely exhaustive, busy culture, and we have lost the ability to recognize the gentle whisper of our Father. And then we wonder why we can't hear his voice. I think God is longing to talk to you. It just may not be in the Disneyland fireworks spectacular. some sophisticated produced music worship service, but a gentle whisper. Lastly, so, you know, we come to the end of this story and you might think like, hey, like some contemplative, mystical experience of Elijah. It ends with him being refueled. That's the last R. Verse 15. The Lord said to him, go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael, king over Aram. And he gives a bunch of other related commands. See, I think one of the problems with the Western church in the last 10 years or so, we have correctly responded to culture by realizing that we need to be missional. That was a bunch of Christianese right there. What I mean by missional is taking your faith outside of these walls on a Sunday morning and taking it to your friends, your family, your coworkers, your neighbors. We've gotten that part. Well, we haven't gotten it right, but we know we should do that. Here's the problem. I think while we have focused on reaching the goal of Jesus, being missional, we have forgotten the way of Jesus. What do I mean? Simple metaphor. We are trying to drive a car into an empty, vast desert with an empty gas tank. It won't work. We are trying to reach the goal of following Jesus, of being missional, but we're not practicing the way of Jesus. I think so many of us need to be refueled to be sent out. And in case you think I'm some mystical weirdo, let me have you take this up with Jesus. Let me show you three verses. This is going to be super quick. Mark 1:35, best book in the Bible. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, there's no Edison light bulbs here, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a, can we say it? Okay, where he prayed. Next verse, Luke 5:15. This is a fascinating one. Yet the news about him spread all the more, so the crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sickness. There's a lot of good things happening here. This is crazy, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed? What? Last one, Luke 6:12. One of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, and he spent the night praying to God. If we want to participate in the ministry of Jesus, and boy do we, New Life's mantra, New Life for the City, we are thoroughly, our hope and dream and vision is to be a missional community. But we will never be a missional community unless we practice the way of Jesus. Silence and solitude. For we need to be refueled to be effectively sent out. You can't go into the desert with an empty gas tank. This morning, I'm just going to end us with my own personal story. Like I said, this is gonna sound crazy. I heard this passage for the first time about a year ago when I was on a retreat. Never heard it before, which is crazy. And the last 2 months I've revisited it. For me, it seems like in the past year of my life, I've been exhausted, busy, worn down, I've had enough. My faith has seemed dry and stagnant and just kind of bland, right? I would categorize myself as addicted to my iPhone, just now learning how to Sabbath well, which is a whole sermon series in and of itself. I mean, I'm kind of right there with Elijah when he says, I've had enough. Not in a suicidal way, but I've had enough. And then just in about the last 2 months, began reading to read books and hear topics on this. And I read this book by a lady named Ruth Haley Barton on silence and solitude. And it has reawakened my life with Jesus. Not just giving you like hoopla, you can ask my wife. So I try, and I'm still learning, right? Haven't perfected this. Just to practice silence and solitude, like 5 to 10 minutes a week. Should do it more. And so for me, that just means like sitting on the couch in the living room and just removing all the noise, all the distractions, and just trying to reflect and center myself on God. Now, I haven't heard like, you know, the audible voice of God or some like crazy vision, which I think those can happen. That hasn't been my story. But I'll tell you what, I have heard the gentle whisper of God. And for me, it's been, Mark, why don't you just stop going and doing and consuming yourself, emailing at midnight, all this stuff. I love you for who you are and not what you do. And the proof of that is the cross. And I can tell you, I'm beginning to be refueled for mission. So like even last Sunday, after the service, like 11:40 a.m., out in that parking lot over there, I was talking to Jordan. He's over here with his mustard shirt on or whatever color that is. Man, I just abused the pulpit there. Sorry, Jordan. Jordan's a great guy. Jordan and I are talking, and I was just getting so fired up and so excited. We're talking about ministry opportunities and possibilities. You can ask him. I just yelled. Am I making this up, Jordan? Okay. I am being refueled for mission. Let's drive the car into the desert because I got a full tank. So I don't know where you are this morning, right? We got the 5 R's. Maybe God is asking you, where are you? And you need to retreat to figure that out. Maybe you need to hear the gentle whisper of his voice. You need to make time and space for reflection. You need to get refueled. He's telling you the journey is too much for you and you need to get rest. And so as we're in this Lent season, let's take up the invitation to grow, to experience springtime, reflection, resurrection. And so that's why we call this the simple life. It's an invitation to practice the simple life, which is actually the best life for you. It's the abundant life with Jesus. And so we're not saying add one more thing onto your busy schedule. I'm actually saying the opposite. Why don't you reduce your busy schedule to simple things? Perhaps that means reprioritizing. So I just want to leave us again. The journey is too much for us. The call of Lent, I think, is a call to remove the things that are distracting us and taking life away from us so that we can experience the abundant life of Jesus. And so I'm going to call the music team back out. We're going to go into our time of response, as we always do. So we have communion over here. Ironic, right? Here's a meal, just as Elijah was provided, that we feed on the death and resurrection of Jesus, which provides us life. You can light a candle signifying the hope that Jesus needs to bring you. We have a prayer team. We'd love to pray for you in any way. Lastly, for Lent this year, we have a special station. There's a cross back over there. And there's pieces of paper on it. There's some paper below with markers. And you can write something on that piece of paper and then clip it to the cross to signify what you need to remove from your life that's distracting you from reconnecting with God. So that is available. And the ushers are going to come forward here now to receive your offering. Which is just an act of worship for us. This is how we partner with God to be a blessing in this city. And so let me just give a short prayer for us, and then the ushers will come forward. God, our prayer is actually very simple this morning. We need you more than we need anything else. So God, I just pray that you would reveal to each person in here what they need to remove out of their life so that they can gain back life in you. May we be attentive to your work. Amen. So we can just invite the ushers forward at this time to receive our offering.